So the part one is the setting of quantum spin systems. So just to remind you, a quantum spin system, at least for this talk, is just a bunch of quantum spins in a line. They're distinguishable. The Hilbert space is that of n quantum spins with local spin dimension d. And these spins, well, it's not entirely necessary to define a state class, but it's useful to have in mind a Hamiltonian for this setting. So we're just going to take a nearest neighbor Hamiltonian for this bunch of spins. I won't be too specific about the interactions here. So in particular, we'll just allow it to be essentially arbitrary. And so the Hamiltonian looks like a sum of local terms, nearest neighbor terms. In this context, I just want to briefly recap the multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz, just so you get a feel for the way we are generalizing it to the continuum and the notation that I'll use in this talk, which will just be slightly different from that of the phrase. So as you will probably recall, a mirror is a sequence of a bunch of steps. What are these steps? Well, stage zero. So we're thinking of a mirror as a state class that results from a quantum circuit in this talk. At stage zero, you have your quantum spins. They're initialized in some zero state. Then you do something to them. You entangle them. So this is this active creation way of thinking about mirror. There's also this disentangling way of thinking about mirror, where you have an initially correlated state. We won't be taking this point of view in the talk. So a mirror is what you get when you start with an uncorrelated state. You apply some local interactions or some description. You do a scaling transformation by a factor of two. You add new uncorrelated spins by an operation that we call R, and you repeat. So to give you the pictorial version of this, to calibrate the notation, here's the uncorrelated spins. Here's some interaction here. Here's the scaling transformation. Here's some new spins there, initially initialized in the zero state. Here's the local interactions again, scaling, new spins, and there's the resulting state there. So this is, for me, in this talk, this is a mirror. It's what you get from a process. And what I want to point out here is that you may notice that there's no role of disentanglers here in this picture. Isometries in this picture. Well, just notice that when you act a unitary. So these blue boxes here are meant to represent unitaries. When you have a unitary and one leg initialized in zero state, that's an isometry. This is how we recover the isometry picture of the standard mirror. So we think in this talk, a mirror is what you get when you apply a local interaction, scaling, all the way up a sequence of times on some uncorrelated state. Thus, I want the first abstract take-home message for a mirror in this talk to be as a dilation and a local interaction. And this is key for the continuum. So we were completely puzzled. So of course, when we started working on CMPS, the first thing we thought was, hey, there's this other class. Let's just make the continuum version of that for the quantum field. But we were completely puzzled because we couldn't work out how to make isometries on a continuous quantum system. So this led me and some others to dictate, to state, this is impossible. There will never be a C mirror. But it took, I mean, there was sort of a couple of real stumbling blocks we had to overcome in order to get to this continuum version. And the first was very trivial. It was simply to change the way we thought about mirror. I mean, probably I was thinking about it the wrong way anyway. And so this is the first step, dilation, local interaction. Well, that's the spin system setting. Let's get straight now to the continuum where life is more interesting or less interesting, depending on your point of view. So thus, we want to talk about quantum fields. So, well, I'll give you my version of quantum fields for this talk. This is a toy picture that, for people familiar with lattice systems, probably makes you feel more comfortable. I'm thinking in this talk as a quantum field is what you get at the limit of the following sequence of steps. So we imagine we have a one-dimensional lattice of harmonic oscillators here. And they're a distance epsilon apart. And associated to each harmonic oscillator, there's at site j, there's a canonical annihilation operator aj. And then we associate with that object psi j, which we saw already in Frank's talk on CMPS. This is chosen, so the aj's and k's satisfy the canonical commutation relations, but the psi j's and k's are chosen so that in the limit we get some an algebra which is more pertinent to quantum fields. So we imagine we take the limit as epsilon tends to zero, these harmonic oscillators get closer and closer, and in the limit we end up with this thing here. So psi of x is meant to be the continuum limit of those psi j's. And these distribution valued operator things satisfy this canonical commutation relation. So this is a standard non-relativistic bosonic field. This is just to set the algebra of operators we're going to work with. Well, mirror, let's just take the continuum limit of a mirror and everything will work out. That was our initial idea, and it didn't work because we didn't know what to do with those isometries. So what I'm going to do is walk you through continuum versions of each of the steps of a mirror and try and understand, or try and argue to you right now, that these are the most natural replacements. I'm going to try and give you a replacement for each step in the mirror. And the simple idea underlying this, of course, is you just make everything infinitesimal. It should work out if you choose your epsilons correctly. Well, let's see. Can we do this? So stage zero, well, that's part of the mirror construction. Better make sure we have a quantum field analog for that. And initially uncorrelated state, I think the most natural thing to put there would be some kind of vacuum state. No particles at all. But I mean a non-relativistic vacuum. So everything today is in the non-relativistic setting. I know that the relativistic vacuum is a much more complicated object. So in a non-relativistic setting, you just put, I would argue, a very natural analog of all zeros is just no particles. So let's replace that with the vacuum. What about this local interaction thing here? Well, I chose that specifically because that has a nice continuum analog. If we have a bunch of unitaries here, this looks like the Lee-Trotter decomposition of some dynamics according to a local Hamiltonian. And there are these degrees of freedom here are somehow a distance epsilon apart. What would be the most natural continuum version of that? I would argue it's do a little bit of evolution with respect to a local quantum, a generator of some local quantum field. So K here is a Hamiltonian, little k here is a Hamilton density for a local quantum field. This is non-relativistic still. And U is the replacement for this local interaction step, and I take it to be e to the minus I delta K. Do a little bit of local interactions. And delta should have something to do with epsilon, but I won't spell that out till a bit later. Scale transform, this had us puzzled for a while. What on earth should be the continuum version of that? Well, actually, it's pretty natural, isn't it? I mean, you need to generate scale transformations, and in continuous quantum systems, this happens to be the generator for that notion. So scale transformation has a pretty natural thing you do, so you do a little bit of scale transformation here. So L generates a scale transformation, delta is a little bit. But this was the part that we were just pushing out to the end. What on earth do we do with these isometries? New degrees, which is just a proxy for new degrees of freedom. So this is completely puzzling. But the answer, which is, I think, pretty non-obvious, was to impose a UV cutoff on K. So I don't expect this to be obvious in this one sentence here, but I'll try and explain now why this is necessary and how this gives you new degrees of freedom. So let's go back to this description of K. So K here, I didn't say anything other than it had to be a generator of just some dynamics and a local non-relativistic field. So in particular, I didn't say that K had a cutoff at this point. So it could do something non-trivial on all momentum.
Is it defined within your boxes?
Is it defined? Sorry?
What is the range of integration?
Oh, okay, so we're thinking about a one-dimensional spatial degree of freedom, so it's the entire x-axis. We're talking today one plus one-dimensional, non-relativistic fields throughout.
So it's not within a box?
No, sorry, that's misleading. Yeah. So the limits here are minus infinity to plus infinity. And why? Well, okay, one sort of naive answer is if you have a UV cutoff, you have a length scale in your in your description. So there you go. Lambda is the length scale, and lambda is the cutoff. Epsilon is the length scale. And let's see what happens if you don't put a cutoff on K. So here's a very bad example. So K here is this guy here. It squeezes bosons at site at position x. The limits are minus infinity to infinity. There's no cutoff in this generator here. And it commutes with scaling transformations. So that's pretty bad, because that would mean that whatever we do to create the C-mirror, the Ks would all commute past to the vacuum. And the scaling the other way around. The Ks commute to the left. The L, the scaling transformations commute to the vacuum. Scaling transformation does nothing to the vacuum, so you're left with just doing some evolution according to this K without the cutoff. So the cutoff really forces a length scale onto K, and that means that K no longer commutes with L. That's one sort of straightforward way of understanding it. And now, I think I'm in a position to argue where these new degrees of freedom are actually coming from, these uncorrelated degrees of freedom. Well, they're coming from the high momenta, because as you apply a scale transformation to your problem, you bring higher momentum degrees of freedom down to lower modes. But those higher momentum degrees of freedom are uncorrelated, because the initial state was uncorrelated. And because K has a cutoff, K can never act on all the momentum degrees of freedom, so that's why they're uncorrelated. So I'll give you, in momentum space, what a sort of cartoon of what a C-mirror actually is doing. So you have, what's going on here is, I haven't labeled the axes, so the x-axis here is meant to be momentum there, and this is meant to be, oops. And on the y-axis, we're talking about the momentum distribution, so there must be a box of chalk somewhere. Oh, right in front of me. So the y-axis on this plot is the expectation value in the C-mirror of the momentum distribution. So this is a cartoon. It's not the real thing, but I think it's an illustrative cartoon. So let's imagine that after some amount of C-mirror preparation, we have a momentum profile that looks like this. So the UV cutoff is about there, K is lambda. So now we apply a scale transformation. So that pushes the momentum profile inwards. And now an uncorrelated momentum degrees of freedom are coming, been dragged down towards the origin. And now we apply K. Now remember, K is a cutoff, so it can't actually act on all momentum degrees of freedom. It only acts on degrees of freedom up to and including the cutoff, and maybe a little bit beyond, but not for much further. So I've drawn the action of K here is to somehow act non. This red dotted line is meant to indicate that K is acting non-trivially on these degrees of freedom, labeled by momenta around the cutoff. Of course, I didn't say, I mean, actually in practice, we find that our Ks act non-trivially from lambda all the way down to zero, but it's not typically not hard to engineer the Ks to have this kind of action there. And then then that adds some new correlations on these new initially uncorrelated momentum degrees of freedom. So it answers itself. When you put the cutoff on, the new degrees of freedom, these uncorrelated degrees of freedom that you need to input in the mirror, the lattice mirror by hand, are dragged in from the higher momentum. With this picture in mind, I just want to write out now what is the variational state class that we call C-mirror. So it's what you get when you apply, there should be a vacuum state just here. It's what you get when you apply a little bit of K, a little bit of L, a little bit of K, a little bit of L, many, many, many times. So we choose this one on delta so that we get a nice limit. Delta tends to zero, and the result, this is the resulting variational state class that we will christen C-mirror, continuous mirror. So you have scale, time-ordered integral from S psi to S epsilon of Ks plus L vs. So a little bit of L, a little bit of K, a little bit of L, a little bit of K. Now notice an important feature here. We're allowing K to depend on this time-like parameter S. Now K, I didn't say anything about K beyond that it has to have a cutoff, but actually, I'll be a bit more specific at this point. K includes all the variational parameters for this state class. I mean, there's no variational parameters in L. L is fixed, it's the scaling transformation, generator scaling transformations. K, on the other hand, is not fixed beyond that it must have a cutoff. So all our variational parameters live in K. And I'll talk more about that in a minute. Now, I'm going to refer to the action of K and L as being somehow an infinitesimal layer of action. So if you imagine in this product here, we talk about each term in the product as a layer. What is the first infinitesimal layer doing? Well, it creates some correlations to UV length scale, and then you do a bit of scale transformation. But since this was the first thing that you did, as you apply more and more and more scale transformations, the correlations that were initially at this UV length scale get spread out until they're at this final, what we might call, infrared length scale.
So at the beginning when you said that, you have a vacuum where there are no particles. So then you add particles.
With K. K is not particle number preserving. We don't take it, we don't make that assumption. Now, the last thing you do, the last term in this product of infinitesimal terms, is creating correlations at the UV scale. So there's a clear mapping between the action of K at different S parameters and scale. So we say that C-mirror have fluctuations from the UV scale to the IR scale, where we label them accordingly. So what's the difference now between a C-mirror and a mirror? We've come on a little journey. We've come from this lattice mirror to the continuous mirror, and it's sort of worthwhile to pause and reflect on what's the difference between these two things. And I would say the main crucial difference between a C-mirror and a mirror is this flexibility in the UV cutoff. So nowhere did I say that we had to use a lattice cutoff on K. We can use a continuous cutoff. We're free to choose all sorts of cutoffs. And that means that you can reinterpret this statement as a mirror is when you use a lattice cutoff, and a C-mirror is when you use whatever cutoff you like, or in particular smooth cutoffs. And this has a really, I think, quite remarkable result, which is that C-mirror preserves symmetries in a very nice way. So you can apply a cutoff to K which preserves translation invariance. And I think that that's really worth pausing to reflect on. So in the mirror setting, when you've used this lattice cutoff and you apply some sequence of interactions and scaling, the resulting state is not translation invariant. It's not manifestly translation invariant. And I guess in practice, isn't exactly translation invariant, although you can recover it via the variational method. Whereas here, it's manifest. You can actually build in translation invariance. And in fact, you can build in the other symmetries, whatever symmetries you desire, because you're allowed to choose your cutoff in whatever way you want. You can build those symmetries in from the start.
Can you explain again what's the analog of having a cutoff in the discrete one? In the discrete one, you have a lattice.
The lattice is the cutoff.
I think I didn't understand why the regulating of this highly high-frequency mode is then the analog of entangling with its vector.
Okay, so if we go back to this picture here, so this is in momentum space.
Yeah.
And so after you've done a little bit of C-mirror preparation, you've created particles at momenta all the way up to the cutoff. Let's imagine we've got that far. And then as you apply a scale transformation, you change the momentum profile in. So now degrees of freedom that were at high momenta are now being dragged down to lower momenta. And so these new degrees of freedom are uncorrelated because they've never been acted on by K. K is the only means by which we create correlations in this entire preparation process. And then they become correlated via the action of K, because K acts around the cutoff. So the degrees of freedom which were initially above the cutoff get dragged in underneath the cutoff. K can then act non-trivially on them, so now they are correlated. So this is the entangling part of the mirror, because we're working in this sort of opposite picture to this morning. So disentangling is what you do when you run this process in reverse. Is that a bit?
I should think of large momenta because it's like probing the
small length scale.
Same way that when I put a zero at each side, it's a fundamental bit of that.
Yes.
That
Can you say more about KDX acting only on a region of momentum space? K?
K, yes. What would you like me to say more about?
Yeah, you depicted as if K is only acting around the top.
That's right, yeah.
What about how do you prevent K from acting? I mean, is that possible?
How do I cut K off?
Sorry?
How am I cutting K off? Is this what you're saying?
How K can act only on those momentum?
So it's all in how you implement this UV cutoff. So the UV cutoff is what stops you K in the first place acting above the momenta above lambda. And I'll just give you an example of a regularization of K that will do this. So suppose K, this is the Hamilton density for K. Suppose that comprised, I don't know, I'm just making this up, right? This term. So you had, suppose I'm going to show you a process to building a K which is regularized. So currently this is an unregularized K. There's no mention of cutoff at this point, plus Hermitian conjugates and so on. Then here's a recipe that will put a cutoff into K and that will give you this, roughly speaking, this picture here. So what you do is you replace each field operator psi, you replace that in this expression here with a smoothed off field operator. I shouldn't use chi in this audience, should I? So some Gaussian weighted linear combination of the field operators. So as long as G is really of tight width, then this almost looks like the original field operator. It's almost a delta function. It's of width epsilon now, and epsilon is literally 1 over lambda. So everywhere in your, you write down some k, it's not cut off, and you say, okay, how am I going to cut this off in a nice way? Well, how about I just replace every field operator by this? This is just one recipe. I mean, there's many, zillions of recipes.
So if you do that, then k is acting only on which
ones? On momenta lower than lambda. So if you take the Fourier transform of this in Fourier space.
Right, so this is actually only the momentum lower than the cutoff.
Exactly.
But not on that particular.
Well, it's got tails.
No, but what you just said is momentum lower than.
Yes, that's true. I made that point when I was describing this plot that, let me amplify that point right now. Here I depict K as though it's only acting around the cutoff, but you're also free to allow K to act all the way down to zero.
Well, my question is, are you free to allow this, or that's the example that you can build in practice?
Both. You could, this is, the examples we use in practice have the property that they go all the way down to zero, or not.
But you could find examples that would not go all the way down
yes.
to zero.
Yes.
Let me just understand. Yesterday, as you said, we could just replace everything by S1.
Yes.
Can I pick your U and the triangle and then take the limit and see that it corresponds to putting a cutoff?
I don't know.
We never saw any expression, we just saw pictures.
Yes.
They also have expressions.
I don't think you can do that because on the lattice you have to make a choice. You take two sides into one or three sides into one. You don't take two sides or one plus epsilon side into one. So there is something rigid there.
I mean the scale by two and here we scale by an epsilon.
Exactly, yeah. So I don't see the obvious way to do that.
This way, I also joined a club of people who thought it was impossible to generalize this to the continuum, which is where we were obviously wrong.
Yeah.
I have two questions. One is, your K, first term, physically when it is acting on something like a Fermi C,
yes.
3x particle board.
Yes.
So that's where you are creating entanglement.
Yes.
Another way, you do it sequentially. But the second thing is, you said that you will add fermions through K. That means you will have terms which are linear in side.
Okay. So in the fermion, so we're in the bosonic setting at the moment. So we're adding particles simply by squeezing. But in the fermionic setting, yeah, there is some subtleties to do with the fact that,
so
and Utah will get to this.
Bosons at the moment.
Yeah, this is bosons at the moment. So Utah will, I think, talk about fermions this up. Yes. So there is some subtlety to do with Bogoliubov angles.
Sorry, but about this lattice, can you implement the RG on the lattice in a way that you don't change by factor of two, but you just start decreasing slowly and readjusting the cutoff?
Maybe. I'm not saying this is the only way to do it. I didn't really think about that, and it's well possible that that also leads to a
converse landscape.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's the intuition here, is that we're merging, say.
But it looks hard in a lot, right? If you take tanks and spend it tonight. I'm not doing a transformation from involving tanks spins. So if you try to take your computer, you try to increase how many spins you're taking to one, that amount minus one, that seems to be more and more non-local. We don't know how to do it. Maybe that's
I know what Frank's on the side.
Frank,
can I give a small comment? So the big difference is that this is all unity, you know, versus the Mira is not unity.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the important beauty. You can do everything in a unity way, and there's no way of kind of losing degrees of freedom in with the finite dimensional problems, because you have. But with the problem of unity, you just lose degrees of freedom by basically.
That's not entirely fair. Yeah.
This morning I presented the Mira quantum circuit, which was completely unitary as well.
No, but you project on these
whole. This projection is like projecting to the.
It's
back.
An isometry.
So I brought all the spins in a product state to the top. And postpone the projection until the last one. So this is not the difference.
I don't think so. Let's talk about it.
Well, you're going to flee before the discussion sitting. So maybe in the question time. That's the state class. I've just written down a definition now. Now I'm going to have to argue to you that all the features that we expect from a mirror, a good mirror, are reproduced in some form in this continuous setting. So it's not entirely fair to call these C-mirror yet, because I haven't, beyond sort of some superficial picture resemblances, I haven't actually shown you that these states inherit the same properties that the mirror would have. So let's start with this flow, RG flow, that a mirror generates. So in the Schrodinger picture, which is where we're acting at the moment, we have a vacuum state, we apply something to it, we get a state. So that's the Schrodinger picture. We're doing something to a state, and observables aren't changing in this picture. And here we go. So we have a state, we apply some unitary, so it's worth emphasizing that the process that generates a C-mirror is unitary, it's not non-unitary, and for notational convenience, we call the process U-S, epsilon S psi. So in the Heisenberg picture, what you get, so when you allow the vacuum to remain unchanged, but instead you act on operators, you generate a flow on the space of observables, an RG flow. So let's see how that comes about. So expectation value. So you've got your C-mirror, and you want to compute, you want to sample from the distribution of A. How would you do that? Well, that's the definition of this expectation value, you want to sample from. Well, one way to do that is you could evolve A in the Heisenberg picture according to this unitary process here, and then take the expectation value with respect to omega. So an expedient to do this is to introduce this ARS. AR is what we call the renormalized operator A. It's when you evolve according to the C-mirror preparation dynamics, not all the way up to S psi, but up to S. And this operator here obeys this differential equation here. This is trivial, right? So K is the entangling bit, and L is the scaling bit. So we get a flow on operators just by following ARS from S epsilon all the way up to S psi. And if we do that on the Hamiltonian, so one important expectation value we need to compute is the energy density. And one way to do that is to start with your bare Hamiltonian, evolve according to U, until we have the renormalized Hamiltonian like this. And this generates a renormalization group flow on theories, because we have the scaling operator, and this means we can have fixed points. Even though this is unitary, this process, we can our flow does land us on fixed points, because it scales away higher order terms in our Hamiltonian. So you might start with some Hamiltonian which is parameterized by a coupling constant lambda. And as we apply this C-mirror preparation dynamics in the Heisenberg picture, these Hamiltonians all start to flow in the space of Hamiltonians. And ones to the left of the critical point here land up at some trivial fixed point, ones to the right end up to another fixed point, And if you're just lucky, you end up on HC, some other fixed point like that. This is a cartoon, of course, of what's going on. So far we have the state class. It's the result of a unitary process. We have the basic idea of, in the Schrodinger picture, we have a state class. In the Heisenberg picture, we have a flow. And now let's go on to compute something a bit more characteristic of a mirror, which might be an entropy area law. So as you've no doubt heard several times now, the current understanding of 1D strongly interacting systems is that they obey area laws of this type. So in a critical system, we expect the area of some region of length A, and we expect the entropy of some region of length A to scale roughly like this. In fact, I guess it's C over 8, where C is the central charge. And in And in 1D non-critical systems, we expect SA to saturate at some constant, not to be confused with a, that shouldn't be the same C, not to be confused with a central charge. Well, what can standard mirror give us? Well, we saw today an argument two times that the entropy of a region of length A can scale like this for a standard mirror. Now let me sketch you the analogous argument in the continuum. Again, by pictures, but we'll have a couple of equations in a second. So the idea is that you suppose you're interested in a region A of the final C mirror. What we're going to do is run this process in reverse and track how big the region A is, because we've been applying a scale transformation. And in reverse, a scale transformation turns into a contraction. So this region starts to contract if you run the C mirror preparation in reverse. And at some point, the width of this region drops below the UV cutoff length scale imposed on K. And at that point, you no longer get correlations between the region A and the rest of the bulk. So the idea here is that as you run the process in reverse, you are generating entanglement, or you're disentangling degrees. Sorry, as you run it in reverse, you are disentangling degrees across the boundary. Because K is local, you expect it only to be able to correlate degrees of freedom across the boundary of A. And it's disentangling these degrees of freedom at some constant rate, and this is, I give an equation for that in a second, and it can do so only until this region reaches the UV cutoff, below which the degrees of freedom are no longer accessed by K. So if you run this process now forward, you can think of a C mirror as entangling degrees of freedom across this boundary for a length, starting from the UV cutoff time all the way up to SXI. And that's just, please ignore that horrible sentence there. That shouldn't be there. And now I want to talk about this rate at which entanglement is generated between the inside and the outside of this region. So there is a conjecture. So unfortunately, this is an argument, not a proof. In the setting of spin systems, this is actually a rigorous statement. But in the setting of continuous quantum systems, I am not aware of a proof of this statement. But there is a pretty reasonable conjecture that under local dynamics, a region of perimeter delta A, the change of its entanglement entropy is upper bounded by the area of the region A, the perimeter. This is certainly true for quantum spin systems, and it can be proved. For any local dynamics, the rate at which entanglement or entropy can be generated across a boundary is proportional to the boundary. And in the continuous system, I'm not aware of a proof. So I'm just saying this is an argument with appeal to a lattice set. If we input this upper bound here into this heuristic argument here, we have to trace this path here and this path here, measure its length, and multiply it by the rate at which we could maximally generate correlations between A and the rest. And when we do that, we're faced with this integral here. We're integrating from some cutoff scale. So this is when the system, the region A, has vanished below the cutoff all the way up to SXI. I think that's meant to be SXI. And we end up with the following result for the entanglement of region A with the rest of the bulk. So we see that in dimension 1, so 1 plus 1 dimensions, 1 spatial, 1 temporal dimension, the maximum entanglement you're likely to encounter should scale like this. So log of L is the length of A, times by lambda, which is the cutoff. is exactly what you would expect on dimensional ground. And then in higher dimensions, we get this following entanglement scaling here. So it scales as the length of the area of the bound.
Right. Higher dimension, how do you generalize K?
So again, we would just have a D. I write it. So in higher dimensions, I would argue a natural replacement for K would be something that looks like this. So this is a Hamilton density for a two-dimensional non-relativistic quantum field.
Your K looks like momentum density. One
derivative. So I'll actually pause to explain this point a bit more. It's a good question. So it looked like the moment I wrote down an example term. So I should actually mention more about what we're thinking about K, because this is where all the variational parameters are. So for us, a K is an infinite sum of terms where we have some OJ. This is little k. I don't know if you can see that from your angle. No, sorry. So this is, we're thinking of the Hamilton density for k as an infinite sum of local terms. You just find some basis of local field operators and generate, and that basis we call OJX. And such a basis might look like this, right? The zeroth order term would be the identity. The first order term would be, I don't know, psi dagger psi. The second term would be psi d psi dx, and so on. So there's an infinite number of local field operators that you could put in that sum. Now, the coefficient of each of those field operators, so these are just numbers now, these are our variational parameters. And that's why in higher dimensions, it's an analogous thing.
Can I ask you about your area law on the rate of change?
Right.
Am I allowed to be confused about that? Because it seems this comes back to Yifei's question. I mean, the K is what's creating the entanglement.
Yeah.
But it's not really only acting at the cutoff scale.
It's not really
acting
really,
all over
it's
the
acting
place.
All over the place. That's right.
I don't think that's. I think that you may extend this to the text everywhere below the cutoff.
Yes,
right?
But K is still local in space. This is in real space. This argument is working.
But I think that that's going to create some more entanglement than you. It might be creating more entanglement than just.
In practical examples, is it dominated by the UV?
Yes.
So it's more that I should think that most of the action is in the UV and there's a tail.
Yeah, there's a tail, generally speaking. Yeah. Is that right, Yuto?
Not really. I'll put fermions with this.
Well, the fermions, yeah, is different.
But the main thing, so K acts on all momentum scales up to some cutoff. But then in the next layer, it will act on all momentum scales up to a slightly smaller cutoff because you have been doing this rescaling in the meantime. So what it did in this first layer, well, the important thing is that it acted correctly, that it did the right operation at the end of the region. It acted everywhere, but what it did at other momentum scales can still be not very physical, can be that this is not good, but still has a chance to correct for this later at a higher layer. So in a certain layer, what it does should be correct for the last part, so it should act in the correct way there, but this doesn't mean that it cannot act at other momentum scales, so that the degrees of freedom act living at these other momentum scales. It should act in such a way that it correctly entangles the degrees of freedom living at the end of the momentum scale region, so around the cutoff. That's the important part of the action. But it doesn't mean that this is the dominant part of the action. Just whatever it does to the other degrees of freedom, it can still correct for in the higher layers. But I will, in my presentation, I will try to make it as clear as possible. I will go through an explicit example and try to highlight all the important steps.
Yeah, so I'll just try and make also an answer. So because we, k is for us local in real space. We think of it as having some velocity, so it has, it creates particles at some velocity. And those particles under some time can only move a certain distance, and the particles are the mediator of correlation creation. So even though it could act non-trivially all the way down to k is zero, it's creating particles in a local region because it's a local operator, and those particles can only have moved a certain small distance.
So it's not just post condensed.
No.
It's putting many parts in finite.
Yes.
That's a nice question. I mean, you say it's creating particles, but entanglement is already there in the vacuum.
I think you may have missed the beginning of the talk.
I did.
Yeah. So
there was another talk.
So when I say vacuum, I don't mean the relativistic vacuum. So this is the non-relativistic many-particle quantum mechanics at the moment. So the vacuum there is the Fock vacuum, empty of particles. So yes, in the relativistic setting, things are quite different.
So this is all non-relativistic?
This is non-relativistic, this talk.
I see.
I would just want to flash up for you now the kind of calculations that we can do with CMERA in a simple quadratic example. This is a free theory. And the purpose of this is to emphasize that CMERA can capture ground state physics for arguably non-trivial models. And the ground state, and not only can it capture it, but it can capture it analytically. So the calculations we're going to do here are analytic, not in fact numeric.
But this is exactly solvable.
This is exactly solvable. I mean, it's quadratic. It's trivial. But it's, again, you know, it's solvable in momentum space, or not even there. I mean, you have to do a Bogle-Biot transformation. But it's solvable in a trivial way if you're willing to go to momentum space. Because CMERA are in real space, things that are trivial in momentum space can look very non-trivial in real space. And therefore, I think it's worthwhile exploring to what extent you can capture trivial momentum space phenomena in real space. So what is this? This is free bosons, non-relativistic, kinetic energy term, some chemical potential, and some pairing term that is bosonic. Well, okay, it's a lot of calculation, I must confess. So to go from the ground state of this, which you can calculate analytically trivially, to a CMERA does take some steps. Yuto will spell out some steps in a relativistic setting in an hour or so. Here's the answer. So what you do is we have an answer, and it's basically analytic. So the K which creates this ground state has this form here, which is admittedly expressed in momentum space. So you might rightly complain that this isn't quite what I was saying K should be. But if you Fourier transform this back to real space, you'll see that K is not exactly local, but approximately local. So if you're willing to allow a little bit of approximate locality in your K, then indeed you can create the ground state. Here's the parameters if you're interested to wind through the expression here, but I think this first formula is the most important one. And this looks like simple squeezing between modes K and minus K. Now, just to end this talk, we had one proposal for a way to get to the continuum limit based on renormalizing lattices, which I hadn't thought of and maybe is worth exploring. I just want to mention another way to get to the continuum based on generalizing the idea of causal structures. So this is not my own work. This is the work of my postdoc, Cedric Benny. But I thought it would be worth just mentioning this because maybe there's some sympathy for this notion here at perimeter. So it's one approach to understanding MERA, which was emphasized by Cedric to me, was that, well, what is MERA? Well, basically, it's some kind of causal structure. Let's strip away unitaries and isometries, and let's just ask, what can influence what when we generate a MERA? Well, if you do that, then you'll see that certain observables at certain scales can only flow to certain observables at other scales. And you can represent this causal structure with a graph like this. And Cedric, this is, again, you can find a lot more details about that in this recent paper here. And you can choose a different coordinate system where that exact where this is, for example, a ternary mirror. So here, this is a this is the causal structure for a binary mirror, I believe. Whatever. And this is for a ternary mirror. And so what Cedric has done here is he's actually embedded these points in the two-dimensional plane here in a very specific way. And I think you can see where this is going. So this is a hyperbolic space. Now, there's a really remarkable result due to Arrighi, Nim, and Werner, which says that if you have causality, then that implies localizability. So this is quite a remarkable result. It says if you have a process where observables can only influence, so this here is meant to represent one moment of time, and this is meant to represent another moment of time. If you have a situation where local observables flow in the Heisenberg picture only to a bounded neighborhood like this, or if you will, in the Schrodinger picture, the things that influence the points in the future light cone are bounded strictly, then this may be represented by a unitary circuit like that.
I'm sorry, I don't see the difference between the two sides.
Okay, if you have this represents a process, so a map, T.
Yeah.
And the only requirement that this map has to satisfy is that T on a local operator is some A prime tensity identity everywhere else. So this is a process which takes a local operator to another local operator acting on possibly more sites. There's no guarantee a priori that that should be representable by local gates. And indeed, it's in fact not true in two dimensions.
It's not, so even this is not true?
In two dimensions, it's not true.
Okay, so this is only for 1D.
This is only for 1D.
So on the other side, on the right-hand side, you have unitary?
Yeah, this can be non-unitary. This
on the right-hand side.
Oh, the right-hand side.
Sorry, yeah.
Oh, these are unitary.
These are unitary?
Yes. And these things here are meant to represent, this is meant to represent isometries here because you've got less degrees of freedom.
So you're expanding.
You're expanding in this particular example here. So the general result can be found in this paper here. So if you have some map which has some causal structure, that may always, in one dimension, be represented by a local quantum circuit like that. So this is quite a remarkable result. I think it's worth emphasizing that just causality alone gives you this structure, whereas in two dimensions there are counterexamples. And then the natural thing, I mean, why has Cedric been drawing these pictures? Well, he's thinking about the continuum. What is this? Yep?
I actually have an example, the shift operator.
The shift operator is very bad.
So what happens in that case?
Well, okay, so in one dimension I kind of lied. So it's representable by unitaries up to a shift.
Oh.
But in two dimensions you can have sort of angular momentum and things like that which really screws stuff up. But in one dimension, yeah, there's this index that you classifies all your local operations. So yeah, I was being a bit sneaky there. But up to a shift, this is in fact true. So you can think of a mirror as just being that causal structure you impose. And what's another thing you might want from a mirror? Well, you might want that the number of variation of parameters in your future light cone doesn't grow too much. In fact, you might want them to decrease to a tolerable amount. And if you impose that, then you have order, causal order, plus a kind of geometry, you know, the number of lattice sites per area should scale not too badly. And that's very familiar, I think, from the continuous setting where order plus number actually determines geometry. So I understand this is I'm well out of my comfort zone here, by the way, so if you want to attack me with many questions, probably won't be able to answer you. But as I understand it, if you impose causal order and you, what's the conjecture that it's not a conjecture, the result is that Minkowski manifold is determined by order and scale factor or something. Conformal, well, whatever.
Yeah, that's a theorem in the continuum. That's
yes, this is in the continuum.
That's where it is in the discrete sense.
Yeah, I'm referring only to the continuum. Yeah.
So by order, you mean the causal structure?
The causal structure.
So it's a in which sense is that an order? It's not a complete order, right?
No, it's a partial order.
Partial order.
Yeah.
And then the number refers to what?
The conformal factor.
The volume of conformal factor.
Yeah, conformal factor. Okay. I'm as I say. read the paper, read the paper. I just thought it was worth emphasizing that you have this continuous, this result of the continuum, but this is sort of suggestive of a continuum analog of the mirror now, right? You have some geometry, and this more or less determines by this result of Zerner and Arigian name a dynamics. So the geometry is the causality is determining the dynamics. And the metric corresponding to this structure here is this one, which corresponds to Desitter space. And
You said it in, say it again.
I believe that's the metric for Desitter. Not
okay.
Anti-Desitter.
So here's a question. Is it the ADS CFT or
I think these are not comparable statements. So today you discussed the ADS CFT correspondence with Mera. And you put the mirror on the boundary. And this is talking about what the causal structure that is in the mirror. So what kind of causal structure would that correspond to in the continuum? And the argument is that that's the Desitter. But this is only on the boundary and has nothing to say about the ADS CFT correspondence. Okay, I won't say anything about that. So that's it. I want to stop now. Take home message. C mirror is a dilation plus a UV cutoff. It preserves symmetries and can capture ground states. Thank you.